The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, welcome everybody. That opening should have said live from the snow-capped mountains of Washington, D.C., where we are effectively snowbound by yesterday's storm. We've got an interesting show for you. We're going to spend the first half of the hour exploring some digital policy issues, talking about net neutrality as well as digital protection and privacy issues. Then we'll spend the second half hour doing a reboot on the Obama administration, what's up with the new team at the White House, and also what's happening with the State of the Union and the fallout from the address the president made earlier this week. But we begin our show with Mark Ellison and Marty Lafferty. Mark Ellison is a partner at Patton Boggs and a former executive in the telecommunications industry, including having served as senior vice president and general counsel for the National Rural Telecommunications Cooperative. And Marty Lafferty is the CEO of the Distributed Computing Industry Association, or DCIA. And Marty has joined the DCIA from a long and distinguished career in new media, where he's been everything from the head, the CEO of the NBC Olympics joint venture online to heading up a number of new media startups, so including names such as Zoom Culture. So, Marty, welcome to the show. Mark, welcome back. We want to talk with you guys about net neutrality today, but Marty, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about your association. What is Distributed Computing Industry Association before we jump into net neutrality?
Sure. Thanks, Kevin. Well, the DCIA is an international trade organization focused on commercial development of technologies like cloud computing and file sharing and other types of stream loading and downloading technologies that have particular interest to content distribution. We started in 2003 with just two founding member companies. We've grown to nearly 140 companies now. We're online at www.dcia.info.
Very good. And let me turn to you, Mark, and sort of have you set the table for what this whole net neutrality battle is about.
Well, Kevin, it's great we've got Marty because he has some of the major players in this fight as members. And it's really something that's been going on for quite some time. If you look back at the history of communication, I mean, going back to even the Telegraph Act from the 1800s, there were talk about treating messages impartially. And during Kevin Martin's administration at the FCC, the commission came down on Comcast because they were blocking traffic of BitTorrent, which is a movie file sharing service. Comcast took that to the U.S. Court of Appeals here in Washington, and in April of this year, the court ruled that the commission did not have the ancillary authority to manage the Comcast network practices. And so since that time, the commission's been trying to find a middle ground to control the flow of information on the network without violating their authority that they have, or moving providers into what's called Title II, which is what telephone companies are under with a complete regulatory scheme. So in December of this year, the commission on a 3-2 vote with the two Republicans voting against the dissenting on the order. They imposed net neutrality rules, really have three major elements. One is transparency, that requires that a provider, a broadband provider, have their rules publicly available. Secondly, it says it cannot block lawful content. And there's a little bit of a distinction between a fixed service and a wireless service under the no blocking. And then the third element was no unreasonable discrimination. It does allow for reasonable network management. Just last week, Verizon and Metro PCS filed a claim, an action in the U.S. Court of Appeals, the same court that had acted in the Comcast matter, and challenged the order on really three or four grounds, saying that it exceeded the authority of the commission, that it was arbitrary, it violated constitutional rights, and was otherwise contrary to law. So now it's up in the air. Also, Congress.
Well, let me interrupt here and to turn back to Marty and ask Marty, how are you guys, your members, affected by these net neutrality rules?
Well, if you go back to what Mark was talking about that started this and drill down behind the headlines to get the real story of what happened following the public outcry over bandwidth throttling, once that was disclosed, I mean, I think it's pretty instructive. And the FCC did a tremendous job of shining a light on what is now kind of a clumsy, outdated technical solution that raised a lot of concerns about fairness and transparency to subscribers and application developers alike. Well, the DCIA had already identified the underlying problem, which in this case you could define it as demands placed on network resources by very active P2P applications, and actually related to that, performance latency in the payload delivery for the P2P. So it wasn't working for either the broadband operators or the P2P software guys. And so we had started a working group to address this as a kind of a joint optimization problem. How do you improve the instantaneous communications between networks by providing some, you know, topology information to the P2P software, and this P2P software application is taking that direction and selecting the shortest route to get to the content they're trying to access. So the group was started by Verizon, you know, obviously a big broadband operator, and Pando Networks, a software company, both member companies. After looking at some work that Yale had done, theoretical work they had done, and it started, had about six member companies, both three ISPs and three software companies, and then Comcast and BitTorrent both joined that group after their particular problem was highlighted. And after a pretty swift process that involved simulations and then proof of concept testing and field trials, a technological solution was developed. It's called P4P. It drastically improved the efficiency of P2P by about 80% and speeded up the performance by about 20%. So, make a long story short, Comcast and BitTorrent made peace. Today, this innovative technology is included in a lot of commercial content delivery network solutions, or CDN solutions, if you will, and it's moving through the IETF standardization process to become a fundamental internet protocol. So, I mean, we believe that this idea of having working groups, that once a problem is addressed, that then the engineers and the software developers tackle that to come up with a solution, which if there had been a premature regulation, they wouldn't have been allowed to work together. I mean, if we look at the impact of some of the more sort of draconian net neutrality proposals that would have frozen innovation, you wouldn't have things like YouTube or Facebook or Twitter. They would have been prohibited. So I guess we want to see the FCC look more at how to open up more bandwidth for other access ramps to the internet, send this issue back to Congress because, you know, Mark will the Communications Act is so woefully outdated now that it needs a total revamp, a total redraft. And really that's what we would like to see government do is take this whole issue back to Congress, work on the Communications Act. Coming out of that, delineate exactly what the commission's rulemaking authority ought to be in this space, and bring this all up to date. The work processes of government, as well as some of the rules we have to live by, are so outdated now they don't really work for the internet.
Well, I know you've got a lot of people that are on different sides of the issue, perhaps even inside your own association. So do you have a unified position, or does the fact that different entities are taking different positions make it difficult for you to have one position?
You'd think it would be a bigger challenge than it is, and we don't speak for individual companies. We don't speak for Verizon. We don't speak for the software companies like BitTorrent, as we've mentioned here, or the cloud computing companies, but individually. But if you look at the common ground, what I was saying about not wanting government intervention at this point, and prematurely setting regulations that would tend to freeze the evolution of internet-based services at this point, but rather foster continued evolution. We're at a very critical point now where trying to move video and very large entertainment content files like video games onto the internet, and there's more innovation going on right now than there has been in years, mostly because there hasn't been a lot of regulatory, intervention that would have slowed things down and made it impossible for this innovation to go on. Now is the time to invest in more bandwidth, accelerate innovation to make this change happen. And we'd like to see the FCC work to open up more access ramps, more wireless, redeploy spectrum to be used as this migration to VoIP and IPTV and the other technologies that will enable really all content to be moved to internet-based.
Sounds like we might have lost Mark there. Mark, you still with us? Mark was actually calling in from a home that didn't have power, so perhaps he lost his juice there. Marty, let me stick with you. I mean, this whole open internet seems related to the relatively newer phenomenon that people hear about called cloud computing.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't having an open internet essential to working and living in the cloud? To sort of paraphrase the commercials I see every day,
it is. I think we feel like we have an open internet, and that's sort of a misnomer anyway. I mean, it's very complex. The network management processes that are in place and that are constantly evolving and improving to handle larger payloads, to find more efficient ways to cache content on the edges of the internet, to use peer-assisted networks, to use fungible data centers that, if you look at the life cycle of entertainment content, where when a movie or a piece of music is really popular, you want tons of storage of that all over the internet. And when it's less popular, you want to reduce that storage down to just what might be needed by a few users who want to access old catalog or old library content, but still have it delivered to them with minimal latency. So you need a very flexible architecture, one that uses all of these technologies and some that we don't even have yet that are still on the drawing boards, to make it possible to deliver a lot more content and exponentially increasing amount of it to more users than ever before at a lower cost and with less friction than ever before.
Well, that is going to have to do things for us there. We've been joined by Marty Lafferty, the CEO of the Distributed Computing Industry Association, and from Mark Ellison from Patton Boggs, talking about the exciting issue of net neutrality. We'll be sure to have them back on to talk more about it. We're going to be back in a minute sticking with this theme to talk about data privacy right back after this commercial.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on. Finish.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. Well, I think we may have messed things up there. We might actually be joined later in the show by Marty and Mark to talk some more about the whole net neutrality thing. So bear with us. We might get them back later in the show to keep discussing that. But we're going to stick with the whole issue of the Internet and privacy, talking a little bit about the evolution of privacy. And we're joined now by Deborah Lodge, who's a partner in the Patton Boggs Intellectual Property Department. She specializes in online privacy and Internet law. And this is a particularly ripe topic today because, well, tomorrow is Data Privacy Day. Perhaps you didn't know that. I certainly didn't know that until we were getting ready for the show. But Deborah, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm very well. Thank you very much, Kevin. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you. And start off by telling us a little bit about recent developments in the privacy area.
I'd be happy to. And, you know, to follow up on something Marty Lafferty noted, there's so much innovation now and different kinds of content available online, and the privacy issues go hand in hand with that innovation. And there has been significant recent developments online in the privacy area. Recently, both the FTC and the Department of Commerce issued reports on privacy. And both explored fundamental issues about consumer privacy expectations, and they both asked for comments from the public.
Very good. Well, tell me a little bit about what the FTC report is all about.
The FTC's report is a preliminary staff report. It was issued on December 1st. It is entitled Protecting Consumer Privacy in an Era of Rapid Change, a Proposed Framework for Business and Policymakers. That about says what the topic is addressed there are, because the FTC suggests a new framework for consumer privacy issues online and how to deal with them.
Well, why don't you tell us some of the highlights of this FTC staff report?
The FTC staff report suggests three basic elements. One is privacy by design. Two is simplified choices. And three is greater transparency. And what they're talking about really is how consumer privacy data is used and collected by entities online. And each of those topics is explored, you know, more in depth in the report. The biggest issue, I think, is that the FTC has suggested that online entities offer consumers a do not track option, and that is a big issue that, that still has to be explored.
Yeah, I think we're all, to a large degree, still learning about how our travels on the Internet are and are not tracked. So tell me, is this an area of growing controversy, and does this report contribute to that controversy, or does it sort of quell concerns people have about privacy on the Internet?
That's a great question, Kevin. I think that it, this is still very much in the developing stage, and I think that the FTC's report has really sparked a lot of debate. And one of the big issues is how can consumer data best be handled, collected, stored, utilized in a way that A, meets consumer expectations, and B, does not overly stifle innovation and development of the online content and use of online issues.
Well, walk me through. You mentioned these three elements: privacy by design, simplified choices, and greater transparency. Let's walk through each of those. What do they mean in this report by the term privacy by design?
Privacy by design is not controversial. It really just means that companies should consider consumer privacy issues throughout their businesses. So that sounds great. The devil's in the detail. What does that mean? How far should they go? Does every company need a privacy officer? What should they do in terms of policies and implementing controls and protections for data? So, you know, it's a key concept and something that every business indeed should consider.
And then the second really theme of this report was simplified choices. What is that about?
Exactly. Simplified choices just means that companies should give consumers specific choices about how their data will be collected and used. Again, that concept sounds basic and simple, and the devil's in the detail. The FTC staff, according to the report, believes that consumers should have to give, quote, express affirmative consent to how their data should be used. Again, that sounds good, but sometimes companies don't totally know what they're going to be doing with data downline, even to help the consumers. One issue with the FTC's report is whether it adopts sort of a distrusting aspect towards what companies are really doing here. So I think that has to be worked out.
So a lot of this sounds non-controversial, so there must be some controversy here somewhere. Where is that?
Well, as I mentioned, the most controversial part is in the Do Not Track proposal that would give consumers a way to stop having the internet, their internet behavior tracked. And, you know, again, that sounds like a good thing. The issue is whether or not there's technological development to make that feasible right now, and whether consumers, in the end, are going to be more dissatisfied if, for example, there's less targeted advertising. Can I just mention one thing, though?
Yeah, please.
You know, I mean, as ever, technology, you know, it leaps before the legal regulation in many ways. Microsoft, for instance, has already announced a kind of consumer tracking mechanism, a do-not-track sort of a procedure. So some of these issues can be technologically feasible.
Now, so there, like any good government problem, there's more than one agency that's engaged in protecting my privacy online. So you've been talking about the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, but also the Department of Commerce seems like a logical place to have their hands in the regulation here. So tell us a little bit about what they're doing on the privacy front.
Well, timing is everything. And on December 16th, the Department of Commerce issued its green paper, which is another privacy report, and it is entitled Commercial Data Privacy and Innovation in the Internet Economy, a Dynamic Policy Framework. So they are thinking along the same lines as the FTC. The Department of Commerce report has some very important principles, and they also recognize the problem that could be generated if government regulations stifle innovation. And I think that's something that, you know, Marty was alluding to in terms of net neutrality principles as well. So the and the comments are accepted by the Department of Commerce. Unfortunately, up until tomorrow, I should mention the FTC is accepting comments on its report up to February 18th. And based on all the comments that are received by these, you know, government entities, there will be new reports that will be issued to further explore all these very important issues.
I see. And are there any other highlights in that Department of Commerce report you think are worth mentioning?
I do. And the Department of Commerce report suggested five key principles as part of this new framework, and they are all very critical. One is privacy principles, the adoption of fair information practice principles. Another one is, you know, international reach, an acknowledgement that, you know, the Internet is international and we need to coordinate our privacy regulations with other countries. Another is voluntary industry standards of conduct, and this is someplace where I think the FTC suggests needs a lot of work, where the industry may come up with codes of conduct that will accept and regulate different privacy standards.
Deborah, I've got just about 2 minutes left, so give me sort of next steps you see the government taking on privacy protection.
Aside from the comments that will be submitted to these agencies, it is also a critical issue in Congress this year. One thing that we need is a federal standard for notice if there are data security breaches. That was something pointed out by the Commerce report, and it's something that I think is likely to develop in this Congress, as well as, you know, follow up on the FTC's proposal on do not track and other kinds of behavioral advertising.
Very good. Well, those people who are interested in learning some more information about this subject, you can best reach Deborah via email. Her email address is dlodge, that's D-L-O-D-G-E, at pattenboggs.com. I'm sure she would be delighted to talk to you a little bit more about what's going on in the world of privacy protection online. We are going to continue our conversation about all things digital and also about evolution in the Obama White House and what's happening with the State of the Union. But first, we've got to go hit a couple commercials. We'll be back in just a minute with more Capital Thinking.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjo Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjo Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, welcome back. We've had an interesting first half hour, talked about the very complex issue of net neutrality with Mark Ellison and Marty Lafferty. Very interesting, given the fact that you've got folks like Verizon running to court to challenge the FCC's jurisdiction in that case, and you have House Republicans who seem very inclined to want to make a big deal of the FCC perhaps overreaching on their jurisdiction and interjecting themselves in the regulation of the Internet. I think that's going to be fascinating. Certainly something we're going to continue to track on the show here for the foreseeable future, because it impacts all of us. Given as much time as we spend online every day, the rules of access, the rules of the road are becoming more and more important, as is privacy. Deborah Lodge, fascinating conversation there, talking about privacy. I often don't think about things, how I'm being tracked on the Internet, until I go to the ESPN.com website and it says, "Hey, Kevin," or I go to my fantasy football team website and it recognizes me instantaneously. That makes you think about who else knows what you're out there doing and where you've been and how much time you spend on the Internet every day. I might be afraid to find out that number. But we want to turn and talk about a couple political issues happening in Washington right now. The big issue of the week, besides the snowstorm that knocked us over yesterday and seems to be putting us largely out of business today, was the president's State of the Union address the other night, his second State of the Union address, marking the halfway point of the Obama presidency and perhaps teeing up, really, the key legislative year for him between now and his reelection. If you subscribe to the conventional wisdom, then you think 2012 is next spring is fairly a lost legislative year for the president, as a Republican House would deny him any substantive policy victories around which he could campaign for reelection. So you have to think this is the year he wants to do two things: get some new things done, perhaps led by the narrow majority that he controls in the United States Senate, 53-47 majority there, get a couple things done that he can work with Republicans on, and blunt the efforts of House Republicans to undermine the critical successes of the Obama administration that he would hope to run on in 2012. And when you get into those, you're really talking about primarily three things. You're talking about the stimulus funding, you're talking about Dodd-Frank reform, and perhaps biggest of all, you're talking about how Americans view health care reform and whether or not they credit the President Obama with passing that when they head into the ballot box in November 2012, or whether or not they blame the president for foisting that scheme on them in 2012 and feel like they'd have been better off with the status quo ante. how Americans perceive those three issues will greatly shape the debate in 2012, and it will greatly shape 2011 as the president tries to shape a legacy for himself through his efforts this year. State of the Union night itself, very fascinating just from watching it. You see, this whole prom date issue at Congress, where this year we all had to find a bipartisan friend to sit with at the State of the Union. You saw some very interesting folks seated together. I had one member of Congress tell me this week some of the negotiations that went on to figure out who you were going to sit with and who you weren't. This member was in demand from a few other folks and was able to dictate the terms. A lot of people don't know that they don't have reserved seating at the State of the Union. If you want to sit on the aisle and greet the president before as he's walking down the aisle and get some FaceTime so your constituents can say, oh, look, there's my congressman shaking the president's hand. Well, you have to go stake that out hours in advance. And this congressman was telling me that his date, if you will, from across the aisle wanted to sit on the aisle and therefore wanted to go early. So the congressman said, well, if you want me to sit with you, I'm not going to go sit all day holding a seat for something that's at 9 o'clock at night. So you save me a seat, and I'll be there. And he was able to dictate those terms because he was in demand. But I did take to heart one of the president's best and most effective lines was, it's not whether or not we can sit together tonight, but whether or not we can stand together tomorrow in working for solutions to improve America. And I think that was certainly one of his best lines and a reminder to everyone there that we have a real commitment to find bipartisan solutions. Now, the president seemed to have a little bit of a Jekyll and Hyde approach to his address. He was praising the Republicans in some respects and perhaps extending an olive branch on some issues where he could work together. But then a few times he was sort of laying down a challenge to say to the Republican majority in the House, see if you can knock me off, see if you can change this law that I passed. And I thought it was a very curious mix for the president to undertake in that respect. Now, if you're interested, we have a ton of information on the State of the Union analysis. I encourage those of you who want more information on the substantive policy areas the president was talking about to visit our website, pattenboggs.com. And there on the front page this week is a downloadable analysis, was produced and it was out yesterday morning, the day after. It's about 14 pages long, and it talks a little bit about a substantive analysis of whether or not the president will be successful in implementing his agenda by area. What I find fascinating about the analysis is comparing the president to some of his predecessors and talking about the potential for a second act in the Obama administration. Again, when you look at what he achieved in the first 2 years, passing the stimulus, passing health care reform, passing Dodd-Frank, whether or not you agree or disagree with the substance of those policies, the sheer magnitude of those policies deserves your political admiration for being able to get them through a Congress that he controlled. It's not easy to do. Those are game-changing, environment-changing policies. And we compare him in our analysis here. We talk a lot about how Barack Obama stacks up against Ronald Reagan in the early days of 1983 and whether or not they have a lot of similarities in terms of what the unemployment rate was like, a stagnant economy, a lack of sort of American optimism for the man on the street, if you will. There are a lot of comparisons. And, of course, Reagan came roaring back to have the definitive victory, political victory of our lifetime in terms of margin of victory. He won 49 states. Walter Mondale won only his home state of Minnesota. Obviously, where he was at the midterm point in January 1983 had very little to do with his reelection in 1984. And I think the conventional wisdom is the same for Barack Obama. You saw this with Bill Clinton as well. Bill Clinton sort of reached the nadir of his presidency in the midterm when Newt Gingrich shut down the government and they had a square off. The president started to rebuild. You see a little bit of that with Barack Obama as well, in that his opinion, his favorability rating and the opinion polls show a pretty significant jump for him since Election Day, somewhere on the net of 8 to 12 points. Now, a lot of that in the last 30 days may have something to do with his response to the Tucson shootings, where he went and gave a terrific speech out there that seemed to remind Americans of all stripes, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, that They like and identify with this guy. You see a real uptick, a double-digit uptick in the president's support among independents, and it's hard to know what that is. Is it Tucson? Is it that we had a holiday season where people did fairly well and the unemployment fell a little bit? Is it a sense that with Republicans having gotten elected to the House, our concern about President Obama overstepping his bounds may have receded as a threat in the minds of a lot of voters who voted against him in November? I don't know, but I suspect it's a combination of all three of those things. But the president, I thought, in his State of the Union, was really launching his reelection campaign. You've seen him roll out a couple of tidbits related to that with his new appointment of a White House chief of staff, and we're going to talk about that after the break with Nick Allard, and with his appointment of General Electric CEO Jeff Immelt to head a new economic advisory panel, this Council on Jobs and Competitiveness, that's not really about the sort of TARP economic recovery stuff. This is really about building a new and better economy, and it's interesting to see he's making some very visible outreach to the business community, a community that he largely lost on the backs of Dodd-Frank reform and on the back of what the stimulus cost the economy in their minds, and on the back of what Obama health care reform might mean to those companies. Now he's trying to pivot, and to use a Clintonian term, he's trying to triangulate between both political extremes and move to the middle. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not he can do that. I think there's a tremendous amount of room for the president to have an agreement with the opposing party on a couple of issues. Clearly, you saw the president reaching out on balancing the budget and fiscal reform. The president reached out on education and competitiveness, which is an area where Speaker John Boehner, as former chairman of the Education Committee, is very interested in reforming No Child Left Behind, giving more power to charter schools, giving more power to parents, and improving an American educational system that's clearly stuck well behind most of our peers in the Western world. He reached out on infrastructure, which is one of those forgotten issues that's very important to us as we develop the means of commerce. It's important we have trains, planes, automobiles, roads, and transit systems that are effective for everybody to use, and the president has reached out and called for some targeted investment there. Now, obviously, that phrase targeted investment came in for a lot of attack by Paul Ryan and the Republicans when they gave their opposition to the State of the Union. I thought Chairman Ryan reminded people of why he is a rising star in the Republican Party. He had a very clear and direct, unvarnished message about the fiscal mess that we're in. He made a factual statement in saying that blame is shared by everyone who's been in Washington recently, regardless of their political stripe, and that we're all going to have to work together to solve it so that our grandchildren aren't left with an unsustainable economy that is spending too much money servicing its debts and can't invest adequately in the things it needs to do to be competitive. I thought it was very interesting to see the positive response that Paul Ryan got. I thought it was interesting to see how many people stayed on later into the evening to watch Michelle Bachmann give the Tea Party response, and how many folks who are not Tea Party identifiers actually thought Bachmann did a good job of summing up some of the challenges that face the country and identifying, laying out some of the principles that really matter to the Tea Party. Now, the Obama White House and what he's doing with his team there is very important to the president's future over the next year. We're going to come back in just a minute and be joined by someone who can walk us through some of the key moves there at the White House. And we'll be back in just a moment with a commercial. More to come here on Capital Thinking.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street, to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, I was rambling on about the State of the Union Address, and now we're joined by one of our favorite guests here on Capital Thinking, Nick Allard, who's the head of the Election Law Lobbying and Political Practice Group at Patton Boggs, and one of the gurus on all things that are going on in Washington. I would be remiss if I didn't remind you that 2 years ago he accurately predicted on this show who would be President Obama's first Supreme Court nominee well before we got to that date. So we enjoy having Nick on. Nick, tell us a little bit. Our topic today is the new chief of staff at the White House, and I know you've just flown in from Chicago. So tell us a little bit about the new man from Chicago that's on the ground here now.
Yeah, well, Kevin, thank you. You forgot to mention anything about my modesty, but we'll just overlook that.
We'll save that for another segment.
And, you know, knowing that the topic was the president's new chief of staff, I was in Chicago doing, research. You know how much I prepare for these spots. This is a very interesting, and I think many people would agree, a very strong move by the president to pick Bill Daley, the former Commerce Secretary under Clinton. And it's very interesting in so many different ways because of sort of the internal Kremlinology, not that I'm equating Democrats with, a communist regime, but just sort of the way the musical chairs move around and so on. Daley has vast experience. He's very able from an organizational managerial point of view. He knows everybody. He has both good relationships with the business community, which is absolutely critical if they want to deliver in terms of jobs and the economy. On the other hand, even though, ironically, perversely, the folks that have the most heartburn about this selection, other than maybe Peter Rouse, who was chewing over whether, in fact, he wanted to become the full-time and permanent chief of staff, is the left of the party, the liberal wing of the party.
They don't like a businessman coming in.
Like a businessman or a person who's been responsible for running government relations and lobbying activities for major companies and so on. And so they don't like anybody that consorts or knows people of that kind, some. But on the other hand, that is kind of ironic because you can't think of the name Daley, and anybody with that name or in that family is somebody who has a long history of being, a genuine Democrat with deep ties and genuine empathy for Main Street and, for example, unions. So he's an exquisite choice in many respects.
But aren't the unions mad at him because he's the guy that they identify as Commerce Secretary who helped get President Clinton to pass NAFTA through a divided Congress, and with three major pending trade agreements? Don't they have some concerns there?
He certainly is pro-trade, and he is somebody that you can probably be counted on to help navigate the president's trade agenda items, which are certainly not in doubt after the State of the Union. That's not something that's going to thrill the unions, you're right.
And obviously the left is concerned about seeing sort of more Clinton faces come back to the White House, and they were hoping for somebody more progressive. This seems like an obvious, I said in the last segment, triangulation strategy, much like Clinton, somebody who can steer you back to the middle. And it also seems like two observations. The president seems to want to surround himself with Chicago inner circle folks, people that knew him before he was Barack Obama. And it also seems like Pete Rouse was a very low wattage guy, very effective, but not a big name. And it seems like once Pete took himself out of the running, the president wanted somebody who was a big name and respected in Washington.
Well, there's a lot in that question. Daley is not part of Obama's inner Chicago circle, and that's sort of one of the issues as to how will he relate and what does it mean for the folks who are on the staff who are. What happens, for example, for Valerie Jarrett, who has, among other things, the portfolio for relationships with business, and you know how is Daley going to work all that out? That's a huge issue. You really have your finger on it when you're saying, on the pulse, when you're saying this is, in a sense, back to the future, because it's just another a very significant link to the Clinton administration. Now, if it's back to triangulation, well, that certainly worked for Clinton with great success in terms of budget reduction and moving things through and welfare reform and some other major issues. So, you know, if the concern is that it's too much like that, well, let's have more of it, because it was certainly very successful for President Clinton.
Well, further that, we're expecting any day, perhaps even today, to hear the announcement of a new press secretary, with Robert Gibbs leaving and Carol Browner announcing she's leaving as the president's special assistant after perhaps being passed over to become a deputy chief of staff. Is this a little bit of a reboot and rebranding of the Obama presidency as he resituates his team there?
Well, it's always a reboot at midterm, this time in a presidency, always. And first of all, there's the burnout factor, and that there's other things for people to pursue. The intensity level of one of the senior positions is not to be underestimated. I think it's just a question of timing and not peak with Carol Browner, and she has, you know, the whole world ahead of her and lots of other ways to serve. Also, it's sort of a fait accompli that David Plouffe, who, is, as we move into the final race towards the next election, will be deputy chief of staff. So, you know, it's going to be interesting what the relationship is with him and Daley, who he, you know, at least technically reports to, or were they some way de facto, because of the relationship with the presidency, they have some kind of a co-partnership chief of staff relationship. But there certainly is a lot of turnover. It's going to be extremely interesting to see who the press secretary is and, you know, what kind of a fresh face that person is able to project to the American people from the White House.
Got about 2.5 minutes left, Nick, till the close of the show. Give me your quick grade of the president's State of the Union address and the thing that perhaps most surprised you about it.
I'd give it a good solid A minus, leaning towards A. I think he hit the note and the tone exquisitely well on violence and the need to cooperate. I think he hit the tone exquisitely well about how America is a special place, and also shifting focus from investment, from spending towards investment. In other words, paying into things that cooperatively can have a yield in the future. So that was all on the upside. I think it was a little bit too much of what is typical. It's just almost irresistible for the State of the Union to be this, but a little bit of a laundry list rather than coherent, you know, whole, fitting down together the individual items. So, you know, in that extent, may have felt a bit short. But I think in terms of tone and image and motivation, inspiration, it was really way up there in A.
I was most surprised by, even though we talked about Tunisia and, of course, Iraq and Afghanistan, usually you see presidents spend more time looking outside the United States the longer they sit in that Oval Office. And I was surprised how much was still domestically focused. But then again, I think our largest problems, the things that factor into whether or not he gets reelected, are here at home. Well, Nick, that's going to have to do it for us in Capital Thinking. We will leave it there, and we will be back next Thursday, hopefully with less snow and more exciting guests. Until then, everybody have a great weekend, and we'll see you then.
Great.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.